listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, to the stage.
U.S. President Donald Trump was in Davos for the World Economic Forum. He spoke on Friday and took questions.
Thank you, Klaus, very much. It's a privilege to be here at this forum where leaders in business, science, art, diplomacy, and world affairs have gathered for many, many years to discuss how we can advance prosperity, security, and peace. I'm here today to represent the interests of the American people and to affirm America's friendship and partnership in building a better world. Like all nations represented at this great forum, America hopes for a future in which everyone can prosper and every child can grow up free from violence, poverty, and fear. Over the past year, we have made extraordinary strides in the U.S. We're lifting up forgotten communities, creating exciting new opportunities, and helping every American find their path to the American dream, the dream of a great job, a safe home, and a better life for their children. After years of stagnation, the United States is once again experiencing strong economic growth. The stock market is smashing one record after another and has added more than $7 trillion in new wealth since my election. Consumer confidence, business confidence, and manufacturing confidence are the highest they have been in many decades. Since my election, we've created 2.4 million jobs, and that number is going up very, very substantially. small business optimism is at an all-time high. New unemployment claims are near the lowest we've seen in almost half a century. African-American unemployment has reached the lowest rate ever recorded in the United States, and so has unemployment among Hispanic Americans. The world is witnessing the resurgence of a strong and prosperous America. I'm here to deliver a simple message. There has never been a better time to hire, to build, to invest, and to grow in the United States. America is open for business, and we are competitive once again. The American economy is by far the largest in the world, and we've just enacted the most significant tax cuts and reform in American history. We've massively cut taxes for the middle class and small businesses to let working families keep more of their hard-earned money. We lowered our corporate tax rate from 35% all the way down to 21%. As a result, millions of workers have received tax cut bonuses from their employers in amounts as large as $3,000. The tax cut bill is expected to raise the average American's household income by more than $4,000. The world's largest company, Apple, announced it plans to bring $245 billion in overseas profits home to America. Their total investment into the United States economy will be more than $350 billion over the next 5 years. Now is the perfect time to bring your business, your jobs, and your investments to the United States. This is especially true because we have undertaken the most extensive regulatory reduction ever conceived. Regulation is stealth taxation. The U.S., like many other countries, unelected bureaucrats, and we have, believe me, we have them all over the place, and they've imposed crushing and anti-business and anti-worker regulations on our citizens with no vote, no legislative debate, and no real accountability. In America, those days are over. I pledged to eliminate two unnecessary regulations for every one new regulation. We have succeeded beyond our highest expectations. Instead of two for one, we have cut 22 burdensome regulations for every one new rule. We are freeing our businesses and workers so they can thrive and flourish as never before. We are creating an environment that attracts capital, invites investment, and rewards production. America is the place to do business. So come to America where you can innovate, create, and build. I believe in America. As President of the United States, I will always put America first, just like the leaders of other countries should put their country first also. But America first does not mean America alone. When the United States grows, so does the world. American prosperity has created countless jobs all around the globe, and the drive for excellence, creativity, and innovation in the U.S. has led to important discoveries that help people everywhere live more prosperous and far healthier lives. As the United States pursues domestic reforms to unleash jobs and growth, we are also working to reform the international trading system so that it promotes broadly shared prosperity and rewards to those who play by the rules. We cannot have free and open trade if some countries exploit the system at the expense of others. We support free trade, but it needs to be fair and it needs to be reciprocal, because in the end, unfair trade undermines us all. the United States will no longer turn a blind eye to unfair economic practices, including massive intellectual property theft, industrial subsidies, and pervasive state-led economic planning. These and other predatory behaviors are distorting the global markets and harming businesses and workers, not just in the U.S., but around the globe. Just like we expect the leaders of other countries to protect their interests, as President of the United States, I will always protect the interests of our country, our companies, and our workers. We will enforce our trade laws and restore integrity to our trading system. Only by insisting on fair and reciprocal trade can we create a system that works not just for the U.S., but for all nations. As I have said, the United States is prepared to negotiate mutually beneficial bilateral trade agreements with all countries. This will include the countries in TPP, which are very important. We have agreements with several of them already. We would consider negotiating with the rest, either individually or perhaps as a group, if it is in the interests of all. My administration is also taking swift action in other ways to restore American confidence and independence. We are lifting self-imposed restrictions on energy production to provide affordable power to our citizens and businesses and to promote energy security for our friends all around the world. No country should be held hostage to a single provider of energy. America is roaring back, and now is the time to invest in the future of America. We have dramatically cut taxes to make America competitive. We are eliminating burdensome regulations at a record pace. We are reforming the bureaucracy to make it lean, responsive, and accountable. And we are ensuring our laws are enforced fairly. We have the best colleges and universities in the world, and we have the best workers in the world. Energy is abundant and affordable. There has never been a better time to do business in America. We are also making historic investments in the American military because we cannot have prosperity without security. To make the world safer from rogue regimes, terrorism, and revisionist powers, we are asking our friends and allies to invest in their own defenses and to meet their financial obligations. Our common security requires everyone to contribute their fair share. My administration is proud to have led historic efforts at the United Nations Security Council and all around the world to unite all civilized nations in our campaign of maximum pressure to denuke the Korean Peninsula. We continue to call on partners to confront Iran's support for terrorists and block Iran's path to a nuclear weapon. We're also working with allies and partners to destroy jihadist terrorist organizations such as ISIS, and very successfully so. The United States is leading a very broad coalition to deny terrorists control of their territory and populations, to cut off their funding, and to discredit their wicked ideology. I am pleased to report that the coalition to defeat ISIS has retaken almost 100% of the territory once held by these killers in Iraq and Syria. There is still more fighting and work to be done and to consolidate our gains. We are committed to ensuring that Afghanistan never again becomes a safe haven for terrorists who want to commit mass murder to our civilian populations. I want to thank those nations represented here today that have joined in these crucial efforts. You are not just securing your own citizens, but saving lives and restoring hope for millions and millions of people. When it comes to terrorism, we will do whatever is necessary to protect our nation We will defend our citizens and our borders. We are also securing our immigration system as a matter of both national and economic security. America is a cutting-edge economy, but our immigration system is stuck in the past. We must replace our current system of extended family chain migration with a merit-based system of admissions that selects new arrivals based on their ability to contribute to our economy, to support themselves financially, and to strengthen our country. In rebuilding America, we are also fully committed to developing our workforce. We are lifting people from dependence to independence because we know the single best anti-poverty program is a very simple and very beautiful paycheck. To be successful, it is not enough to invest in our economy. We must invest in our people. When people are forgotten, the world becomes fractured. Only by hearing and responding to the voices of the forgotten can we create a bright future that is truly shared by all. The nation's greatness is more than the sum of its production. A nation's greatness is the sum of its citizens. The values, pride, love, devotion, and character of the people who call that nation home. From my first international G7 summit, to the G20, to the UN General Assembly, to APEC, to the World Trade Organization, and today at the World Economic Forum, my administration has not only been present, but has driven our message that we are all stronger when free, sovereign nations cooperate toward shared goals, and they cooperate toward shared dreams. Represented in this room are some of the remarkable citizens from all over the world. You are national leaders, business titans, industry giants, and many of the brightest minds in many fields. Each of you has the power to change hearts, transform lives, and shape your country's destinies. With this power comes an obligation, however, a duty of loyalty to the people, workers, and customers who have made you who you are. So together, let us resolve to use our power, our resources, and our voices, not just for ourselves, but for our people, to lift their burdens, to raise their hopes, and to empower their dreams, to protect their families, their communities, their histories, and their futures. That's what we're doing in America, and the results are totally unmistakable. It's why new businesses and investment are flooding in. It's why our unemployment rate is the lowest it's been in so many decades. It's why America's future has never been brighter. Today, I am inviting all of you to become part of this incredible future we are building together. Thank you to our hosts. Thank you to the leaders and innovators in the audience. But most importantly, thank you to all of the hardworking men and women who do their duty each and every day, making this a better world for everyone. Together, let us send our love and our gratitude to make them, because they really make our countries run. They make our countries great. Thank you, and God bless you all. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. President, for this inspiring speech. As it is tradition at the forum, I will ask you one or two questions. And my first question is, why is the tax reform, why has it been of such a high priority for your administration?
Well, first of all, Klaus, I want to congratulate you. This is an incredible group of people. We had dinner last night with about 15 leaders of industry, none of whom I knew, but all of whom I've read about for years, and it was truly an incredible group. But I think I have 15 new friends. So this has been really great what you've done in putting it together, the Economic Forum. The tax reform was a dream of a lot of people over many years, but they weren't able to get it done. Many people tried. And Ronald Reagan was really the last to make a meaningful cut and reform. And ours is cutting and reforming. We emphasize cut, but the reform is probably almost as important. We've wanted to do it. It is very tough politically to do it. Hard to believe that would be, but it is very, very tough. That's why it hasn't been done in close to 40 years. And once we got it going, it was going. And the big, and I wouldn't say a total surprise, but one of the big things that happened and took place is AT&T and some others came out very early and they said they were going to pay thousands and thousands of dollars to people that work for their companies. And you have 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 people working for these companies. And all of a sudden, it became like a big waterfall, a big, beautiful waterfall, where so many companies are doing it. And even today, they just announced many more. But every day, they announce more and more. And now it's a fight for who's going to give the most. It started at 1,000. Now we have them up to 3,000. This is something that we didn't anticipate. Oftentimes in business, things happen that you don't anticipate. Usually, that's a bad thing. But this was a good thing. This came out of nowhere. Nobody ever thought of this as a possibility even. It wasn't in the equation. We waited. We said, wait till February 1st when the checks start coming in. And people, Klaus, have a lot more money in their paycheck because it's not just a little money. There's a lot of money for people making a living doing whatever they may be doing. And we really thought February 1st it was going to kick in and everybody was going to be, well, we haven't even gotten there yet. And it's kicked in. And it's had an incredible impact on the stock market and the stock prices. We've set 84 records since my election, record stock market prices, meaning we hit new highs 84 different times out of a one-year period. And that's a great thing. And in all fairness, that was done before we passed the tax cuts and tax reform. So what happened is really something special. Then, as you know, and as I just said, Apple came in with $350 billion. And I tell you, I spoke with Tim Cook. I said, Tim, I will never consider this whole great run that we've made complete until you start building plants in the U.S. And I will tell you, this moved up very substantially. But when I heard 350, I thought they were talking $350 million. And by the way, that's a nice size plant. Not the greatest, but not bad. And they said, no, sir, it's $350 billion. I said, that is something. Well, we have tremendous amounts of money, including my newfound friends from last night. Great companies. They're all investing. When one of the gentlemen said he's putting in $2 billion because of the tax cuts, I said to myself, wow, he's actually the cheap one in the group because they're putting in massive numbers of billions of dollars. So I think you have a brand new United States. You have a United States where people from all over the world are looking to come in and invest. And there's just nothing like what's happening. And I just want to finish by, I have a group of people that have been so out. So I have a whole lot of them. So I won't introduce because then I'll insult at least half of them. But I've had a group of people that work so hard on this and other things. And we're really doing, we had a great first year, so successful in so many different ways. And there's a tremendous spirit. When you look at all of the different charts and polls and you see, as an example, African-American unemployment at the historic low. It's never had a period of time like this. Same with Hispanic. Women at a 17-year low. It's very heartwarming to see, but there's a tremendous spirit in the United States. I would say it's a spirit like I have never witnessed before. I've been here for a while. I have never witnessed the spirit that our country has right now. So I just want to thank you all and all of those that are pouring billions of dollars into our country or $10 into our country. We thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. President, I will ask you maybe a personal question there, but before doing so, I would like to acknowledge the strong presence of your cabinet members
here,
who tremendously contributed to the discussions.
Good.
The last
I would like to do that. That's very good.
Yeah. Now,
Stephen, Wilbur, Gary, Robert, even my general and my various other generals, you know, we're making our military protection a little bit better for us, too. So thank you very much. Does everybody understand that? I think so. So thank you all for being
now,
here.
Now, my personal question would be, what experience from your past have been most useful in preparing you for the presidency?
Well, being a businessman has been a great experience for me. I've loved it. I've always loved business. I've always been good at building things, and I've always been very successful at making money. I'd buy things that would fail, that would be failures, and I turn them around and try and get them for the right price, and then I turn them around and make them successful. And I've been good at it, and that takes a certain ability. And, you know, historically, I guess there's never really been a businessman or business person elected president. It's always been a general or a politician. Mm-hmm. Throughout history, it's always been a general. You had to be a general, but mostly it was politicians. You never have a businessman. And then, in all fairness, I was saying to Klaus last night, had the opposing party to me won, some of whom you backed, some of the people in the room, instead of being up almost 50%, the stock market is up since my election almost 50%, rather than that, I believe the stock market from that level, the initial level, would have been down close to 50%. That's where we were heading. I really believe that. Because they were going to put on massive new regulations. You couldn't breathe. It was choking our country to death. And I was able to see that, Klaus, as a business person. The other thing is I've always seemed to get, for whatever reason, a disproportionate amount of press or media. And throughout my whole life, somebody will explain someday why, but I've always gotten a lot. And as a businessman, I was always treated really well by the press. You know, the numbers speak and things happen, but I've always really had a very good press. And it wasn't until I became a politician that I realized how nasty, how mean, how vicious, and how fake the press can be as the cameras start going off in the back. But overall, I mean, the bottom line, somebody said, well, they couldn't have been that bad because here we are, we're president, and I think we're doing a really great job with my team. I have a team of just tremendous people, and I think we're doing a very special job, and I really believe it was time, and it was time to do that job, because I don't think the United States would have done very well if it went through 4 or 8 more years of regulation and really a very anti-business group of people. We have a very pro-business group. We have regulations cut to a level. In the history of our country, Klaus, this was reported recently, in 1 year, we've cut more regulations in my administration than any other administration in 4, 8, or 16 years in the one case. We've cut more regulations in 1 year, and we have a ways to go. I mean, we're probably 50% done, and we're going to have regulation. There's nothing wrong with rules and regulations. You need them. But we've cut more than any administration ever in the history of our country, and we still have a ways to go. So I think between that and the tremendous tax cuts, we've really done something. And one other thing I said, and I saw it last night with some of the leaders and the business people, I think I've been a cheerleader for our country. And everybody representing a company or a country has to be a cheerleader, or no matter what you do, it's just not going to work. And the reason I'm a cheerleader is because it's easy, because I love our country, and I think we're just doing really well. And we look forward to seeing you in America, special place, And where you are is a special place also. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. President, for being with us. The World Economic Forum community, who is assembled here, will be certainly, and I quote you from the last piece of your remarks, will be certainly be among the hard-working men and women who do their duty each and every day, making this world a better place for everyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Release the memo. Russiagate morphs into FBI gate. Also, are the U.S. and Turkey on the path to confrontation in Syria? And the great debate. Jordan Peterson is called a one-man army and has taken the internet by storm. Crosstalking FBI gate, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Victor Olevich. He is a political analyst as well as a leading expert at the Center for Actual Politics. And we have Dmitry Bobich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. And you always can jump in. Dima, let me go to you first here. Are we going to see a new meme, a new debate, like who lost Turkey? Because if we remember when the communists came to power in China, there was who lost China, and it ruined a lot of careers because people didn't get it right, okay? Who's losing Turkey? Who's gaining Turkey? Go ahead.
Well, let me remind you that in 1999 there was a big debate who lost Russia. And it was at the times when supposedly Russia was so democratic, Mr. Yeltsin was still in power. And these honest guys, Chubais and others, whom the report quoted as having conned us out of a few billion dollars, right? That's about, you know, the honest Yeltsin's guys, the young reformers. But what's going on now between Turkey and the United States is unbelievable. I mean, trying to remove a relatively loyal regime in Syria, which, you know, Mr. Assad was oriented towards the European Union more than towards Russia. The United States and NATO lost a much more important country. Turkey.
Yeah, but what they might lose, they might lose an alliance on top of it. Go ahead.
Look, the United States today faces a very stark choice. The U.S. has the Kurds in Syria as about the only force, the only viable force.
And they're embedded with the Kurds.
That would support partition of the factual partition of Syria, and that supports the U.S. And if the U.S. can support the Kurds, and then it gets the ire of Turkey, we see that happening now, or the United States can stop supporting the Kurds, Turkey would be happy about that, but then the United States would be left with almost no credible, serious support force on Syrian territory.
And no reason to justify their continuing presence
in the
country.
So the choice is ally with the Kurds and have Turkey as an adversarial power, considering that Turkey has the second largest army in NATO. Very, very serious question.
Mark, one of the things is, too, is that Erdogan, he can't afford to lose in Syria. He's put too much into it.
Oh, yeah. He's politically, security invested. I don't believe that peace in Syria is possible. The question isn't while Bashar al-Assad continues in Syria, but while Erdogan continues in Ankara. Erdogan must go. Hashtag Erdogan must go.
You've been in the military. What is the possibility of some kind of confrontation here? Because just as I just said and you just said here, Erdogan is not going to back down. This means a lot to him and his legitimacy at home and the ongoing problem they've had with Kurds here. The United States... Is it so important to the United States? Because if you look at the defense community, the intelligence community, even in the U.S., they're divided about what's going on here.
Yeah, so in fact, you're starting to see splits, not only among the administration, but in the foreign policy blob between the neocons and the liberal imperialists. They're divided on this issue, and Victor is exactly right. You either get a Kurdish protectorate carved out of East Syria to continue to destabilize Syria and weaken Iran, thus by weakening one of their allies, or you get to continue your relationship with Turkey as a member of NATO and a U.S. Turkish alliance, which allows U.S. military bases in Turkey that their flights are necessary for controlling the region. Also gives the United States access to the Black Sea, which is Russia's underbelly, of course. So there's big geopolitical questions here. But obviously, this is a self-created blowback. We've been saying on the show all along that if the U.S. tried to partition East Syria with the Kurds, they would face blowback politically, both from Turkey and from Iraq. Likewise, Erdogan has created this situation where he calls Kurdish terrorists. There's no evidence that any Syrian Kurds have been involved in terrorism on his territory, but he created this by illegally arming, training, and salarying sectarian militants.
Well, and the United States
did by arming and supporting
the Kurds here.
There's one good thing about all of this situation. Finally, we heard the truth about the United States financing terrorists out of the mouth of babes. No, out of the mouth of Mr. Erdogan. And so he is
the guy who financed terrorists.
Excellent. Well, that's why I say that it's not exactly mouth of babes.
There's no shortage of people arming and funding terrorists.
It's not an innocent baby, but he basically admitted something that all the other NATO members have known, but they have been hiding it. Yeah. So Erdogan, having been put in this quagmire, where he drove himself by his decision to change the regime in Syria, he is now, I'm sorry, he's now spewing out the truth.
Let me frame this, though.
The existence, the possibility of a Kurdish state on Turkish borders is an existential threat to Turkey. Sure. And any president of
that's
any leader
perception
of Turkey,
that's
whether his name is Erdogan or anything else, would do right now do exactly what Erdogan is doing vis-a-vis the Kurds. Mm-hmm. Yes, he made mistakes. I agree wholeheartedly with Mark as far as that he got this started. He was one of those that supported the Syrian civil war. He created the situation where the Syrian Kurds, who have now more power, more autonomy, and more willingness to act against Turkish interests.
Then under Assad.
Yeah, exactly. But is Erdogan, he has to choose now. I mean, if he continues down this path and he wants to drive all the way to the Iraqi border here, I mean, is he going to have to choose NATO or not NATO? I mean, where's the level of negotiation?
It's a gray zone. He's not willing at this point to take Turkey out of NATO. There isn't even a mechanism set for that. But at the same time, Turkey and Erdogan is not going to do anything that will endanger the national security and sovereignty of the Turkish state.
Okay. Who's bluffing here, Mark?
Everyone's bluffing. Everyone is bluffing at this point, including the Syrian government and Russia. The Kurds in Afrin have now officially called publicly for the Syrian government to help come in and protect them against the Turkish invasion. This isn't going to be met because they aren't fully agree to demands that Russia and the Syrian government set for them, which included completely dismantling the Kurdish militias and either moving east to the U.S.-controlled territory territory or joining the Syrian army, plus relinquishing control of oil fields in eastern Syria,
if the Kurds, before this incursion started a little over a week ago, if they had just taken the deal to pick up the Syrian flag,
That was the minimalist demand. They accepted that. There was a maximalist demand from Russia and the Syrian government, and there was no negotiation. A compromise position should have been official. The Kurds are offered that at the time. They're offering that now. That's not enough.
They have a habit of choosing the wrong side.
Yeah. Well, you know, when one chooses the wrong side, one pays. And that's what the Kurds are doing now.
Let's hope that the Kurds will have a voice at the Congress of Syrian Minorities that is going to be held in Sochi, you know, in the coming days. But actually, if you look at the pattern, it repeats itself. In Syria, you know, the foreign invaders, I'm sorry, they have been trying to remove the Syrian government, creating more and more problems. Right. You know, the United States intervened in Syria in order to replace a person who was not actually anti-Western, Mr. Assad. And they've got a terrible problem with the Islamic State, you know, which was much more dangerous than 10 Assads taken together, right? Turkey wanted to put its own people in power in Syria. They've got the Kurdish state right next to their border.
But so it seems like it's the worst possible outcomes, if you look at it here. I mean, Victor, how does this change? I mean, the rest of Syria, we have reconciliation going on. The Syrian army is essentially won against these terrorist groups. It's just the border area between Syria proper and Turkey. Is it a new conflict, a very different, and it can be confined?
And now Turkey will have to clean this up near its borders. Every single power that in the region that has a significant Kurdish population, Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria, is opposed to an independent Kurdish state. So it's not just Turkey. Every single nation.
How does this play into the huge minority of Kurds inside of Turkey and what's going on in Syria? I mean, do you foresee a lot more blowback now?
Well, that's obviously the concern, and the Erdogan regime has forbidden Kurds to protest against this euphemistically named operation.
Unbelievable.
Olive Branch. Unbelievable. As he's invading Syria and bombing cities. Let's frame this properly. Erdogan, who has all along been the war against Syria couldn't exist without the Turkish border,
right,
the Disneyland it provided for jihadists, the moms training centers that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia sent up to funnel salaries. And there's Turkey is still supplying al-Qaeda with weapons for offensive. They are literally, as reported in the Western mainstream media, doing joint patrols with al-Qaeda and attacks on Afrin, as they call someone else terrorists. It's just Orwellian. It's Orwellian. Okay. And this could lead to Turkish confrontation with the U.S. Their proxies aren't having a good time in Afrin, and they're already starting to attack the Kurds in Manbij.
The U.S. has lost in Syria, and now it's going to potentially suffer another loss against a NATO ally. It's really quite amazing.
Well, I think, again, the only good outcome here is that we are hearing the truth. I think what the German media is saying about Erdogan and that Mark has just quoted, that is most likely the truth. But what Erdogan is saying about Germany is now is also truth. You know, Germany is not democratic. You know, it prevented Erdogan and Turkey from appealing to their citizens on the German territory during the elections. So no one is good in this situation. And the good thing is that they unmask each other. We see the truth now. We couldn't see it in the beginning.
It seems to me that, and we're going to have to, we'll be doing this in the future here, but this conflict is definitely transforming, and it has much less to do with Syria than it does with foreign players inside of Syria.
Yes.
Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, gentlemen, let's switch gears here. We're being promised, I don't know if it's going to happen, Victor, but this week we'll get that four-paged memo released to the public that is details the use or misuse of FISA warrants to listen on into American citizens. The GOP, of course, is spinning this as some kind of silver bullet. The left is dismissing it as a conspiracy. Victor.
It is not a silver bullet. It is unlikely to change the trajectory of the Robert Mueller investigation and his way towards unseating an elected American president. However, it's part of a trend towards the unmaking of the American political order. Now, what the Democrats and the American security services started hoping to remove Trump really backfired, and we see that. And yes, they will go on; they will try to remove Trump, but at the same time. The damage that they're suffering, and it's not just them, but the American political system is suffering, is severe.
You're consistent in your position, and I like it, and we're going to see how it plays out. I'm keeping track of everything you've said on this. Mark, but still, I would say, countering Victor, is that so far Russiagate has yielded nothing, okay? A few indictments, but none of it has to do with Russia. But if this four-page memo, from what we've heard, this is an unmasking of the highest levels of the FBI. And it shows that how intelligence was weaponized against political foes. That will be the real scandal. I don't know if the media, if the liberal media will reflect that. But in fact, that may be what's happening. Go ahead.
But you might have a problem with that. But I don't think the majority of the media has a problem with that. And I don't think the majority of the American people really care on either side what's going on at this point. There was a CNN political reporter, Maiv Reston, who admitted on Inside Politics this week that all CNN talks about is Russia, this Russiagate.
But no one really cares.
No one out in the United States actually cares. I kind of agree with Victor. I don't think this will be a silver bullet either way. I think, you know, this witch hunt will continue. I'm far more interested in the way that the Democrats and the media have tried to frame it. They have argued through this anonymous propaganda unit, the Alliance for Securing Democracy, Hamilton 68's dashboard, which purports to follow a group of Russian bots, even though Twitter says they've shut them all down, that they're not going to name. They never name who they're actually following, that they purport to be promoting.
Well, they're obviously following you, Mark. What?
No, because I've never hashtagged any of these things that they're talking about. I mean, last week, these Russian bots that they follow, the primary thing that Russia was promoting via social media was Monday Motivations. I mean, because obviously Monday Motivations is a Putinist plot against the United States.
When you were talking about Syria, you're saying the masks are coming off. I think in this case, the masks are coming off as well.
Well, the masks have been coming off for the last, I would say, 2 or 3 years. You know, FBI, at least Edgar J. Hoover, at least he acted secretly. Okay, he tried to influence the internal politics of the United States, but he had his secret files, and he had to die before, you know, the truth came out.
He probably wouldn't have used Twitter.
He was simply a much more decent person than
he wasn't decent.
He was much more effective.
He was more effective, but he wasn't decent.
That's what I say. He was more decent than the guys who are acting now. I mean, Mr. Comey, who was first accused of acting against Hillary Clinton when he didn't stop the investigation against her right before the election, now he's been lionized by the media, you know, as a person who was...
No, that's liberal propaganda.
You know, the funny thing is, now Comey is being considered for a professor's position teaching ethics at the university.
And Peter Strzok will be his teaching assistant.
Exactly. I stole that from Victor. Yes, that would make a great pair there, I think.
This is very serious right here, because it shows, I mean, I've said this on this program before, you know, people have a right to their opinion, and you can say whatever you want about the President of the United States, but if it's connected up with your job in stonewalling or creating an artificial trap, as it appears to be unraveling. You know, there's a lot of other text messages we need to read, but I mean, it certainly is suggestive.
You know, Russiagate is really not about Russia. Russiagate is about American security services, the American intelligence community, unlawfully, unconstitutionally...
See, Mark, that's what I'm getting at.
...inserting itself into domestic American politics. Yeah. Russiagate is about American media that, instead of doing its job,
is doing the bidding of the CIA, of the FBI, and the other agencies that are controlled, by unelected officials with special connected with special interests of the American elite.
We all agree
that is what RussiaGate is about.
Yes. Yeah, I think we all agree on that. And not only the media is acting on this, but the partisan divide. There's always the hope that enough Republicans will be outraged by Trump's behavior to swing this. Because we have to remember that Russiagate is a smokescreen designed to keep this going until the midterm elections, right, so the Democrats can ride this. And then they can push for impeachment. Why? Because impeachment is not a legal process.
It's
impeachment
is a
political process. So it's a vehicle. Russiagate is a vehicle for them to go after Trump, but it doesn't necessarily have to come back with any evidence of collusion. Again, they're again pushing for obstruction of justice charges, and Trump says he's willing to testify in person, which is a huge mistake.
I think he should reply in writing.
That would be via
perjury.
There are two prongs where the opposition to Trump, the American political establishment, the deep state is going. The first prong is pressure on Trump's family members, Jared Kushner and Ivanka. There may be an attempt to basically put an ultimatum in front of Trump. Either you step down at some point, or Jared Kushner is going to be...
That is never, ever going to happen, Victor.
But we will
find out. Okay, and
the second
prong
is obstruction of justice charges, where Robert Mueller is going right now.
Okay, we'll find out, gentlemen, here. All right, I want to switch gears here to the what I thought was really one of the most incredible examples of TV discussion. It was Jordan Peterson on Channel 4 discussing with the interviewer, Kathleen Newman. Initial reactions, gentlemen, because I thought it was very, very interesting, an ideological conflict, and I think the winner was quite obvious. Dima, did you watch it?
Well, I did, but, I find it all just a part of the same thing, disfranchising the people. Your opinion does not count if it doesn't coincide with the opinion of the mainstream globalist liberal elite. And this is the same thing with the elections. You voted for Mr. Trump, but your vote is not quite legitimate. You are not eligible to vote people if you vote for someone like Trump. And the lies continue.
But what was interesting about Victor is that from my position sitting in this chair here, is how this interviewer was constantly trying to reframe the argument over and over again, based on a rabid ideology, I would say, and without facts. And that's what made the debate really interesting, is because Peterson always came back with facts and knowledge. And that's what I thought the juxtaposition was here, was rabid ideology, and it was done very sloppily.
And that's why there are so many viewers who watch this debate who are talking about it. Why does this happen? This happens every time when you see somebody saying something that is outside that framework that the liberal Western media tries to force
on people.
This type of debate or these types of programs were on different subjects, whether it's subjects concerning gender, whether it's subjects concerning politics, other
immigration.
Once you get out of that framework, people actually start watching, start talking about it, because people do not believe. Yes, there are many that switch on CNN and think, yes, that's 100% truth.
Yes.
But there are many that do not believe that, and they want to see the truth being
or if anything, see a real debate.
Yes,
not
exactly.
These fake debates that the mainstream have the time.
So by squashing real debate channels and media outlets like CNN, like MSNBC, ABC, NBC, and so forth, they're really creating a problem for themselves.
Right.
Because eventually millions of people
Do you see these news outlets? They are the quintessential examples of ideological groupthink.
Yes. And people will go somewhere else.
I agree
with you completely. The most amazing thing was how she continually tried to repackage what he was saying in terms that she would rather argue against, to build up straw men
so what
and
you're
knock
saying,
them down.
So what you're saying,
saying, no, that's not what I said. And that was actually the majority of the debate. No, that's not what I said. You're trying to read what you want into what I said. And you know, this continued from the both day. And they're both actually arguing from ideological positions. He just presented his in a lot more reasoned arguments. And this, you saw what was an interview turn into a debate. And I think...
and a train wreck for one of them.
More than just the style of it. I think there was... there's a lot of things that I very vehemently disagree with Jordan Peterson with. But his talking about... he didn't use the words, but he's, you know, talking about evolutionary biology. He's talking about sociobiology, right? About fundamental sociological, biological differences between the sexes, which I agree with. He talked about the difference between equality of potential, of opportunity,
and
compared
to
between the forced equality right. of outcome, which I agree with completely. And what he's talking about there is, to me, in this particular issue, the difference between classical feminism, which was about providing that equality of opportunity, and where this
now
has gone. I don't agree that it's Marxist in the slightest. It's actually postmodernism stolen from the Frankfurt School, which, as far as I'm concerned, is anti-Marxist. But it's they're pushing a forced equality of outcome, which goes against these social,
I
biological,
think,
and
to go back to
Dina's
point, we've run out of time, gentlemen. Yeah. I think that's why, or actually it was Victor's point, that's why so many people watch it, because they realize what they hear 24/7 is ideological nonsense. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here, RT. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.